We have a very interesting subject this morning, and one that probably is not often discussed these days, and that is the story of Aesop the slave. Very little is known about him historically. A few references in Herodotus. For the most part, he is an apocryphal figure. He's a mysterious, uncertain, dimly perceived personality who probably lived about 550 B.C. The meager descriptions that we have tell us that he was a slave, that he was deformed, he was a hunchback, and he was born dumb without the power of speech. But through the intercession of a goddess, probably Athena, his speech was given to him, and he went about telling fables, telling short moralistic stories, pointing out the integrities and lack of integrities of his contemporaries. Because of his unusual wittiness and brilliance, he was freed by his master, but because of the sharp barbs in his stories and the rather sadistic attitude he took towards the dominant policies of his time, he was finally framed on a charge of robbery and executed. This is all that we actually know about him. Now, the fable, as it stands by itself, apart from him, is usually a very short story with a very definite moral purpose. Fables are of many kinds. They are symbols, they are emblems, they are various devices of words to reveal unusual or significant meanings. From the collections of ancient fables that we have, it would appear that they taught essentially the same moral and ethical principles that we hold today. In other words, the ancient fable is a definite link in the descent of the integrities which we cherish now. But the fables point out that 2,500 years ago, they had the same integrities and also abused them. The same corruptions must have been present because the fables point these things out. And they are of a kind and nature that helps us, perhaps, to understand the great span of human effort for the last 3,000 years. The origin of these fables is uncertain. A few probably can be attributed directly to Aesop, who gained a reputation for them. But the collections that have since been formed under his name did not all originate with him. There probably are not more than 50 of the fables that can definitely be traced to Aesop. Of the rest, more than 500 belong to various collections and classifications, interpretations and interpolations that assembled themselves later. One of the most interesting aspects of the fable is to try to find out in what part of the world it began. About the same time that Aesop was telling his stories and pointing out his little moral lessons to the Grecians, Gautama Buddha was using precisely the same methodology in his so-called Jataka tales. These Jatakas are really stories, presumably, of the previous incarnations of Buddha. And they go all the way back to his embodiment in various animal forms and the experiences that happened to him in these forms. There are the same moralisms, the same basic statements of integrities, and they were compiled at approximately the same time. We have not much understanding of contact between Asia and the Greek states at the time of Buddha. We know that the travelers from eastern countries, merchants particularly, did carry various goods along the caravan routes and were finally able to dispense with these goods at Ephesus, Antioch, and Alexandria. Therefore, there is no doubt that a certain amount of literature, a certain amount of legend and story followed the caravan routes and became accessible to the European and Near Eastern people. In any event, the two patterns are almost identical, and some of the actual fables are on exactly the same themes. So that somewhere in the past, there was a contact between the East and West on the level of moral stories. Now, the fable is a very brief story, nearly always, seldom exceeding 100 or 200 words, sometimes not more than 50 words. But it tells a happening. It sets up a story of some kind. Now, the problem of the fables of Aesop have been somewhat complicated by the fact that most of his fables involve animals. The various fables that we have from him, and many others, including the recension of his fables by Fontaine later, these all humanize the intellects of other creatures that are not human. They make these creatures think as we do. They place them in situations that are uniquely human. And they bestow upon the animal the same essential integrities and vitalities that we associate with human beings. This has in turn led to considerable expansion of language and to the development of many ideas and concepts that have come down to us in nursery rhymes and Mother Goose stories, such as, for instance, the dog in the manger, and others of a similar nature. These fables began to appear in print almost immediately after the discovery of printing in Europe in 1450. And from that time on to the present day, every change, every development, every curiosity of printing can be traced directly from editions of Aesop's fables. All the famous printers made copies or published issues of these fables. And from the earliest printings, which were in the 1480s, to the present time, there's probably never been a year in which some version of Aesop's fables has not been in print. We wonder sometimes why these have had such a tremendous tenacity. We wonder why great artists like Dürer and Gustave Doré illustrated the fables. We also know that many of the early woodcut artists did their beautiful descriptive pictures of these legends and fables. Every type of illustration, from the poorest caricature to masterpieces of painting, have been dedicated to this theme. About 1840 or 50, an edition of some of Aesop's fables appeared in China, and the Chinese translation became immediately popular. It became so popular that finally it came to the attention of some of the officials, who decided that Aesop was downgrading the Mandarins, that he was picking on the rights of royalty to rule and all this type of thing, and they banned the fables. It is very likely that the opinion of the Chinese in the 19th century is the very point of view that resulted in the execution of Aesop in the 6th century B.C. So we have all kinds of associations involving these peculiar fables and legends. Now, the problem that we probably always face with this type of literature is to try to trace its development. We know that from the beginning it was very simple. We know that it borrowed very heavily from Oriental sources and North African sources, that it was supplemented and intensified and further amplified even as late as the period of Charlemagne in Europe. Some feel that the stories were brought to Europe by the Crusaders, who found them in the Near East. More theorizing on this subject is perhaps available than almost any other example of literary problem. I think, though, we must gradually come to the realization with these fables that some peculiar circumstance brought them all together, and also gave a very much more sprightly insight into the nature of Aesop. This comparatively forgotten figure, who probably never was a very famous man, even in his highest moments, this figure was embellished, enriched, and to Aesop was attributed much of the moral literature of the civilized world. He gained great importance, and the number of his fables was strongly increased during the Alexandrian period in Egypt. Now, Alexandria was a tremendous center of literary creativity. We know that the Alexandrian people were responsible for the rise of a large number of apocryphal things. They were responsible for the appearance of sacred books that were not found in the original biblical canon. They were interested in the Gnostics. They gained a supremacy in the Kabbalah and all kinds of metaphysical beliefs. Neoplatonism, Neopythagoreanism flourished there. Alchemy found it a great center for the promulgation of its concepts. And here, in the midst of all this, comes a sudden amplification of Aesop. It would seem probable that actually the Aesop's fable structure that we know now, not the separate fables, but the assembly of them and the increase of their number, both of these were due to the Alexandrian factor. A whole group of scholars in Alexandria about the time of the Emperor Augustus were hard at work backdating more recent writings. These scholars would take something that was developed in Alexandria and attribute it to someone who had been dead for 500 years. This seemingly not only increased the merit of the production in the public mind, but lifted from the contemporary authors the responsibility. In other words, if you could say that you were only reprinting something that had been written much earlier, there was less likelihood of you being accused of treason or something of that nature. So that the Alexandrian nexus was certainly important in the development of Aesop. And the morality of the Aesop fables show definitely the influence of the Gnostics, the Neoplatonists, early Christian mysticism, and the early Jewish philosophies. It's very unusual situation, one that practically demands some type of investigation, or at least a realization that you're dealing with a traditional classical composition. Another possibility involving the Alexandrian situation is, as we know, the Alexandrian libraries were destroyed. They were accidentally burned by Caesar, and were intentionally destroyed finally by the caliphs of Baghdad. In the interval of the destructions of these various libraries, there perished, it is believed, nearly 1 million ancient records. These included books that we have heard of by name only in the writings of various authors, but the original books were destroyed. One group of literature after another faded away. Ancient tablets, historical records, scientific knowledge all went up in flames together in the Bruchion and the Serapeum in Alexandria. Now, it's always possible that many of the ideas and even documents that we now believe were fabricated by the Alexandrians may have actually existed. Copies were made of them, and the originals were lost in the destructions of the libraries. So it is not fair to say with certainty that all the backdating was false. Some of it may have been based upon lost originals that were destroyed by the vandalism of unhappy and unfortunate human beings. In any event, the fables come down to us. Now let us consider the fables themselves a little bit in the same spirit that we might consider the fables of the various Arabic poets or East Indian philosophers, or even taken as fragments out of the sacred writings of the East or of Persia or the ancient Babylonian Talmud. All of these writings have little stories in them which could be dressed up and become a powerful moralism with a little dramatization and the creation of a small plot to give special meaning to the various exercises or beliefs. So now then, we'll take just one of the fables to start with, which I think is a good example. Once upon a time, any time, a group of foxes helped a lion on the hunt. The lion asked them to assist him in capturing a deer for dinner. And the foxes were very agreeable, and they helped him, and the time came when the hunt was successful. And they all gathered around the lion. The lion said, "Now skin the deer and divide it into four stacks," there being three animals involved beside himself. So it was divided, and the lion, the king of beasts and the mighty one of all, declared that he was the one who was going to divide the food. And he said, "First, the first quarter goes to me, because I am the majesty, I am the ruler of the forest. That's my right. The second quarter goes to me because of the fact that I was the one who was selected to legally arbitrate the distribution. The third quarter also goes to me because of the fact that I was the one who led the chase. And as to the fourth quarter," the lion stopped for a moment, he said, "let me see anyone take this from me on any grounds." Now, the moral is down in the lower line of it, where it says, these little people can help the great people to be rich, but they must not expect to benefit anything from the wealth. They will not get any of it. It will all stay with the big people. Now, we have some complaints like that wandering around here at the present time. And there is an appearance that for 2,600 years we've been doing approximately the same thing. Now, another one of the fables that doesn't deal with animals in this particular case deals with a very old man, tired, who gathered wood in the forest. And his back was bent, and he grew more and more infirm, and he grumbled more and more. And he put these bundles of faggots together, and finally one day he's called out in a loud voice. He said, "Oh, I can't do this any longer. I want death to come and take me." And about that time, death popped up and said, "Here I am." Well, the man said, "I'm awfully glad to see you. Will you help me put these faggots on my back?" The wisdom of these rather subtle stories is so apparent and so cutely contrived that they have become more or less patterns for whole novels. Whole books have been written to amplify the very simple statements that are found in the Aesop fables. There is another one of the fables that I think we are mostly familiar with, and that is the fable of the sour grapes. Everyone, I think, knows that story, of how the fox tried to get the grapes off of the lattice work that was protecting the vines. And he jumped and he cried and he crawled and he did everything to try to reach the grapes, but he couldn't reach them. So finally he turned away and said, "Well, they were probably sour anyway." From which we have a statement we commonly use, sour grapes. One after another, these stories seem to fit into our needs. There's another one that has a little political implication that is rather cute, and that is the one about the frogs. A whole group of frogs were in a pond, and they were living very happily and pleasantly together, but they seemed to feel the need of some kind of leadership. They wanted something to look up to. So they prayed to Zeus to send them a leader. And Zeus looked the situation over carefully, and he dropped into the pond a large piece of wood, a shapeless piece of an old tree trunk, and said, "There's your leader." Well, when he dropped this wood in the pond, the frogs were so frightened by the noise and the disturbance in the water that they did not even dare go near the log for a long time. But finally, they got more and more courageous and more daring and got closer and closer to the log until at last they found out what it was. And they were very unhappy and disappointed because they had asked for a leader and all that was given to them was a log. So they asked Zeus a second time to send them a leader, and he sent them a heron, a bird with very long legs and a long beak, who was particularly fond of frogs. And as a result of this, in a very short time, the heron was eating the frogs. And the survivors again besought the help of Zeus to do something about this problem. And Zeus told them they'd have to take care of themselves from that point on. When they had no strong leader, they were happy. When they got a strong leader, he exploited them. And Zeus told the frogs very simply that any time you have a strong leader, you are apt to have someone that will eat up the frogs. In other words, the stronger the leader, the more likely he is to prove to be a dictator or something of that kind and destroy the very people that he is supposed to lead. And the obvious moral of this and other ones of Aesop's fables is that it is better to have a respect for a comparatively unknown leadership or something that is just there than it is to get a nice, strong leader who in turn will use the people for his own advantage. So there must have been some place back in Greece or in India or somewhere where this particular circumstance inspired a fable. And these fables are always inspired by some circumstance that occurred. Then, of course, there is the fable of the boy that cried wolf. This is one of the most basic of the old fables. There was a young shepherd, and he had to take his flock out into the meadows, and he was lonesome. And he wanted some company, and he didn't know what to do. So he finally hit upon the idea of crying wolf and going into town and asking the townspeople to come out and help him protect his flocks. And the townspeople, kindly enough and willingly enough, did it. And he had a wonderful time. He enjoyed himself so much that a few days later he cried wolf again. And they all came out and helped him the second time. And he thought he really found a solution to being lonesome. In the meantime, a number of actual wolves got around the flock and began to look as though they intended to take away some of the sheep. So the young boy this time, in all seriousness, yelled, "Wolf!" But no one came. And the result was that the animals devoured a large part of his flock. So he wanted to know why they hadn't come this time. And the townspeople, represented by an elder of the group, said, "If you lie often enough, you will not be believed when you tell the truth." And this, the cry of wolf, has simply come down to us as a symbol of this kind of deceit. Another interesting fable is that of the dog and the bone, which Aesop is believed to be one of his original fables. In this case, a dog walking across a little bridge with a bone in his mouth happens to look down into the water and sees a reflection. And the reflection looks like another dog with a bone in its mouth, and he immediately decides that he wants the second bone also, in addition to his own. In order to get the second bone, he opens his mouth and snaps at it, and the real bone in his own mouth falls into the water and is lost forever. So that the moral of it is, when you're not satisfied with what you have, you'll probably lose what you already have trying to get something you do not have. And this, again, could be considered more or less contemporary as far as our problems are concerned. In the course of time, we also find that a varied group of legends have been involved into the fable structure, such as many of the fairy tales and such stories as Cinderella, and various folk legends of European peoples. They have gradually been built into moral stories. And one point that is quite obvious is that nearly all your fairy tales have happy endings. In other words, in the end, virtue has to triumph. And it is this triumph of virtue that really becomes one of the main points in the Aesop collection of fables. It must be that the integrities and values of life are preserved regardless of the vicissitudes of living. Another interesting fable tells of the story of a dispute in heaven. In this particular dispute, it is assumed by one party that all living things will be the same, regardless of what kind of bodies they're in. And the other point of view was that if you change the body, you will probably change the personality and the appetites and the conditions. So as to prove this, the gods took a cat, and they transformed it into a beautiful maiden, and arranged this maiden to be married to a human being. And the marriage was a great success, and there was no vestige of the cat in the maiden at all. It looked as though they'd won completely and could collect the wager. But the goddess Venus said, "Wait just a moment." So she created a little mouse and put it in the room. And instantly, the beautiful maiden pounced on the mouse. And Venus said, "See, never changes. Opportunities change, but the old ways still linger." And Aesop uses this fable to explain a great many problems of human life, that no matter what condition we find ourselves in, the essential traits of our characters remain much the same. And the fact that we are rich or poor, handsome or homely, makes very little difference. We will be what we are. And under pressure of circumstances, we will go back to the basic circumstances of our own temperaments and dispositions. And so it goes through a whole group of these very interesting and wonderful stories. There's a story relating to industry that is quite cute. There was a fox who was very thirsty and found a jug of water. But the neck of the jug was small, and he couldn't get his snout into the jug far enough to get the water. And he was really dying of thirst, So it was a very serious emergency. So he pondered and he thought and he wondered. And finally, he had an idea. He took little pebbles and one by one dropped them into the urn until the pebbles raised the water level, then he could reach it. Then he had the water that he needed and was very happy there afterward. And the moral of this is that when you are in an emergency, there is nearly always a solution if you think it through. Every mystery, every problem can be solved. The only problem is whether you have the ingenuity to solve it. Another one of Aesop's fables, which probably began in Alexandria, is the story of the old man who left nothing to his son but a wooden idol. And this wooden idol was very, very little compensation to the young man. But the father told him, he said, "This idol can be of great service to you. Therefore, never neglect it. Always respect it and continue to keep it in your family." So the young man did as he was told, but he was poor. He prayed to the idol, but nothing happened. And finally he said, "The idol is phony. It doesn't do anything for me." And he took an axe and he struck the idol with the axe. The wooden image broke and was filled with cold coins inside. This was an instinct or an impulse to always expect to find something valuable inside of anything that has received long and definite veneration. You can apply this to wisdom, to ideas, to notions. You can even deny them. You can say there's nothing to them. But rather, if you explore them, examine them, and find what is in them, nearly everything is useful. Nearly everything has a constructive meaning if you wish to search for the solution to the mystery. So this fable, I think, was Alexandrian because it is not as clearly in the spirit of the original morality of Aesop as some of the other better-known ones. Most of the animals and birds and so forth in the Aesop fable collection are humanized. And I remember old Ernest Thompson Seton, who was probably one of the great naturalists of his time, he told me one day, he said, "You know, this has been a trouble with humanity from the beginning. We have always assumed that other creatures are like ourselves but unable to express what they are like. In other words, we take a lion or a bear or a horse and we give it a human mind instinctively, even when we work with it. In the family, if we have a cat, we talk to it just as though it could understand what we say. If we have a horse, we pat it and we assume that it loves us or cares for us or is interested in us. And we take all kinds of animals and we humanize them in our own approach, giving them our own peculiar abilities and using them as symbols of our own attitudes." Diogenes, a famous 15th and early 16th century physiognomist, used animal faces to indicate human temperaments. He's declared that all human beings, to some degree, are reminiscent in appearance to some non-human creature. The old senator, who was called Eaglebeak, because he was had a very prominent nose and a bald head, was assumed to have the same general temperament as the eagle. And in many cases, the physiognomist, even as recently as Lavater, who was probably the greatest of them all, was able to prove that there is a certain reminiscence of appearance to various other creatures to be found in most human compositions. Astrologers say that this is due to the fact that people born under the different signs of the zodiac take on something of the appearance of the sign creature under which they are born. Therefore, the Leo person has a sort of leonine look, And the Virgo person is extremely human and almost completely normal in appearance, one of the few signs in which there is practically no vestige of animal prominence due to the fact that the sign is completely human. Then there are people who are heavy set, like the Piscean fish, or there are those who have the goat look of the Capricornian, and the Taurians sometimes have the heavy neck of the bull and protruding eyes. These were, according to the ancients, indications that the animal propensities were to be found in human beings, and that in those where these propensities occur, the temperaments or traits of character would also carry over. As a result of that, it was useful in cartooning and caricaturing to represent human beings by various animals, insects, and birds. It seemed to be something that we instinctively do. And in the same way, we bestow upon these creatures our own attitudes and assume that they think as we do, and that they believe as we believe, and that they have peculiar emotional and psychic reactions to us. Now, your American Indians and most primitive people have a certain close psychological sympathy with animals. The American Indians, for instance, the Plains Indians particularly, had to hunt to survive. They had not developed any agrarian propensities. They had no way of providing food except by following the herd of buffalo and things of that nature. But the Indian never killed for sport. He never destroyed any life for fun or merely to demonstrate skill. He had no problem of thinning out of herds because this situation didn't exist. But the Indian also always regarded the animal as, in a strange way, human. He would talk to the animal. He would try to explain why it was necessary for him to kill in order to feed his family and to take care of the responsibilities of his tribal life. But the Indian had an interesting little addenda that he put on nearly all of his hunting activities. He believed that someday human beings would be animals, and animals would be human. And he also, therefore, said when he asked the animal not to hold it against him that he had had to kill him for food, he said, "If later I am an animal and you are human, and you have need of food, I will give my body to you." It was a peculiar attitude, but it was one that represented a very great sincerity of motive. The Indian never believed in destruction. The Indian also, of his own nature, bestowed upon animals certain psychic propensities. He also regarded them as the symbols of his clans and tribes, a heraldry of totemism, in which each animal had its clan among humans. And you see this development in the historical tribal records found in the totem poles of the Northwest. All of these animal totems were beings. They were gods, or nature spirits, guardian principles. And these animals and humans had a fraternity, a kinship, a common community of life and interest. And these animals, according to the legends, talked with human beings in dreams and visions. And there was very little division between the animal kingdom and the human. Now, we know today that there is some form of communication between other creatures and man that we do not fully understand. I think I have told you before that Seton told me on one occasion that it seemed to him that to the animals, human beings were gods. That in some mysterious way, the animal worshipped man without knowing what he was, much as we worship deities without knowing what they are. As an example of that, he said that one day when he was out in the plains, a hunter was chasing a deer. And this hunter had his gun, and he was trying to get the deer into position to shoot it. The deer represented the fear of the animal life of man, was terrified, and somehow seemed to know that its life was in danger, even though the hunter had not fired his shot. The deer, to escape the hunter, rushed to Seton and stood alongside of him, even though Seton also carried a gun. The animal seemed to know that this man would not hurt him. And animals have on a number of occasions taken refuge with human beings to escape other human beings. Such habits or attitudes are very difficult for us to understand. But Burbank had the same idea with plants. And there is a whole fabulism of plants if you want to study it. According to Burbank, the plant does not have the human sensory perceptions. It does not have five senses as man has. But he said in his researches he had discovered that in its own world and in its own life and in its own way, plants had more sensory perceptions than human beings. They are different, but they are there. And he estimated that plants, a fairly developed plant, probably had in the neighborhood of 20 sensory perceptions. These perceptions were useful only within its own world, within its own kind. We know, for example, the experiments made with labyrinths and plants.